Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, June 24th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. 9 people shot in a Charleston, South Carolina church. The shooter, a young man who made his motive clear. Is this an act of terrorism? Should the media be calling it as such? Is this about the Confederate flag or the N-word? The president used it. A CNN anchor held up a sign with the word printed right on there. Is the media moving the conversation forward or just stirring the pot? Drop that interim in Lester Holt's title. He's now the full-fledged anchor of NBC Nightly News. We'll talk about Brian Williams' apology tour and what exactly we think he's going to do at MSNBC and what the rest of the NBC News team should take away from the announcement and how it all happened. And the detail with which the St. Louis Post-Dispatch covered a sexual assault claim at the Capitol. Did it need to go as far as it did? There's a lot more that hopefully we're going to get to as well, but we'll start with pop princess Taylor Swift taking a bite out of apple. Wrote an open letter to Apple protesting an agreement the company made with record labels not to pay artists royalties during the 3-month free trial of its new streaming music service. Her message was simple. We don't ask you for free iPhones. Don't ask us, meaning Swift and her fellow recording artists, for free music. She said she wanted her fans and Apple to understand why she was withholding her wildly popular album, 1989, from the service. Elvis Costello had actually tweeted a link to the letter, calling it a note from our future president.
I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but she certainly has had an outsized influence on the largest company in the world, basically. I mean, she shamed them in a very clever, polite way through social media to get them to back off of a plan that a lot of smaller artists, frankly, who are going to be hurt a lot more by that Apple decision, to rescind it and say, you will get royalties even through this free trial period of our new music service.
I think basically what she did, and I think what other artists have been complaining about for a long time, is that we're not going to give it away for free, because once you go down that road, it's hard to pull it back, and someone's going to make money off of it. I think, as we've talked about a lot on the show, the newspaper industry went down that road. Google and other aggregators made a lot of money off of newspapers giving away their content for free. And I think the music artists and others have learned that you're just not going to win in that scenario.
No, I mean, that was the first thing that came to me. Why didn't we have somebody like Taylor Swift 15 years ago who was saying to all these publishers, wake up, you're giving it away for free. You won't be able to sell it very easily down the road.
That's right. I think, and I know why Apple was doing it, because basically they're trying to get people to move to their streaming service as opposed to going to Pandora or Spotify or whichever other ones you want to bring up.
And she's pulled this with Spotify before, taking 1989 and some of her other albums as well off of Spotify because of the fact it doesn't pay royalties at a rate that she thinks is appropriate. Yeah. This time, though, Apple took notice, and Apple is much bigger. That's where a lot of this news comes in. Maybe Spotify isn't as popular with the music audience as is Apple.
Well, and Apple has to worry about what this says about their reputation, because they're the cool kids on the block. I mean, as Taylor Swift's referring, we have our iPhones. We don't expect you to give them to us for free. They risk damaging that reputation, because what they'd basically done is negotiated a deal with the record labels, not with the artists. And it was independent artists, not Taylor Swift, who is going to be hurt by all of this. And yet, because she has her own independent label, which her family owns a big chunk of, she can afford to do this. So it's I mean, it was courageous on her part, but I think she was probably one of the few people who probably could have done this and had the impact that she did.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But I also believe that the record industry or the recording industry, they really need to take a look at this and think about not just themselves and what they're getting out of it, but also their artists as well, because these artists can move around. They are under these contracts, but these contracts aren't as long-term as they used to be.
Well, and Mike had brought up that idea of wishing that somebody had this idea within the journalism industry 15 years ago. With music, it isn't quite as far gone because people have been conditioned through their use of iTunes or other programs similar to it, Google Play or on Amazon, of making that micropayment, maybe paying that 99 cents per song or that $1.29.
Although I do think that the music industry, the recording industry, especially these big record labels, have been hurt in the same sort of way that the newspaper industry has been hurt. But because these artists also have concert revenue and other ways of getting money, and there isn't an ability to reach folks with direct downloads over the internet, maybe the artists haven't been hurt as much as the record companies yet, but they're threatened with a lot of harm, and that's why this action by Swift is really important, I think.
Well, I wish I could count just how many hours have been spent talking about what happened last Wednesday night at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. And for 2 years, the three of us have sat at this table and talked about the need to bring context to those conversations as we have them. We've challenged those producing those stories and scheduling those guests to push the conversation further, to go beyond the surface, and to call things as they are. And once again, I find myself about to play a clip from The Daily Show, in which it seems one of the only people putting it into brutal perspective is, again, Jon Stewart.
We invaded two countries and spent trillions of dollars and thousands of American lives, and now fly unmanned death machines over like five or six different countries, all to keep Americans safe. We got to do whatever we can. We'll torture people. We got to do whatever we can to keep Americans safe. Nine people shot in a church. What about that? Hey, what are you going to do? Crazy is, right? That's the part that I cannot, for the life of me, wrap my head around. And you know it. You know that it's going to go down the same path. This is a terrible tragedy. They're already using the nuanced language of lack of effort for this. This is a terrorist attack. This is a violent attack on the Emmanuel Church in South Carolina, which is a symbol for the Black community.
NPR's ombudsman took a look at why that organization wasn't using the term. She talked to experts and she looked at the federal statute. She even looked up the word terrorism in the dictionary. Merriam-Webster defines it as the use of violent acts to frighten people or as a way to achieve a political goal. To me, at least, it feels like a term that fits what happened last week. But there are a lot of news organizations reluctant to use the label.
And I don't understand why they're reluctant to use the label. It's terrorism. And it's terrorism that's been going on since the 19th century. The dictionary term that you just described has been going on in this country, revolving around race, revolving around religion, for decades, for a century. And we in the media continue to say, well, it's this, well, it's that. No, it's terrorism. It is domestic terrorism on a small scale. Oklahoma City, domestic terrorism on a large scale. It is terrorism.
I mean, not every mass killing is also terrorism, but this one obviously is. And you pointed it out in the definition. It's the political intent is what makes it terrorism. And what I find kind of strange is that can we not use more than one label at the same time to accurately describe an event? It was domestic terrorism. It was also a hate crime. It was a killing spree by a deranged gun. It's all of those things, right? Can't we keep all of those balls in the air at the same time? As long as we're accurately describing what's going on and we're not just doing it glibly or without thinking, there's nothing wrong with using labels that accurately reflect what happened.
Yeah, this is the part that I don't understand. Why are we having this large discussion about what we call it? People were murdered. You know, they were murdered in the church, in a place.
In a sanctuary. In a sanctuary. Literally in a sanctuary.
And literally in a sanctuary where they were supposed to feel safe. Mm-hmm. And they invited this person in because they believed that they could help him. And in return, they were murdered. And we're talking about a flag. We're talking about the president using the N-word. We're talking about terrorism. I mean, there are other things that we should be talking about on a larger scale than these three things.
No, I agree with that, and I'm sure we're going to get into that in a second. And the only thing I would say in addition, there are some government, you know, investigators who say, well, maybe it's not terrorism because he wasn't affiliated officially with some sort of known terrorist group. Okay, if you want to go there, I mean, that's logical, but then, all right, how about lone wolf, quote, Islamic terrorists who weren't officially affiliated with Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram or whatever? Are they not terrorists either? Let's be consistent.
Well, so as you said, there has been a lot of talk about that flag and the appropriateness of flying the Confederate flag over the South Carolina Capitol, about Walmart and Sears and some other merchandisers no longer selling products with it on there anymore. Even here in mid-Missouri, state legislator Chuck Basie took heat for his participation in a Civil War tribute and was accused by some there of possibly saluting the flag. It's a symbol that for many is very, very painful. It's a reminder of institutional racism in this country. And by now, you've probably heard this, the president on comedian Mark Maron's podcast. We're going to warn you, this audio is unedited and does contain language many find offensive.
Racism, we are not cured of.
Clearly.
And it's not just a matter of it not being polite to say nigger in public. That's not the measure of whether racism still exists or not. It's not just a matter of overt discrimination. Societies don't overnight completely erase everything that happened 200 to 300 years prior.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest has said that Obama hadn't gone into this conversation planning to use the word, but stands by it and believes he used it in context. The media's reaction to it and fixating on it, it's detracting from some of these other issues that are far more important that you were talking about.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I even though he may not have had that in his plan statement, he knew when he said it, mm-hmm. what it was going to bring out, and he was trying to make a point. That in and of itself is a story, but it shouldn't be the story, and it's become the story, and that to me is the problem, because it's not his use of the word, it's what he was basically saying is, we need to figure out a way to deal with the issue of race in this country and have some honest conversations across racial lines, class lines, gender lines. We need to do that, and we haven't done that.
And that message has been lost entirely.
You know, I don't know if it's been lost entirely, but I do think it's appropriate for us to say, well, when the president uses that word, then the media should report on that fact. But to report on that exclusively, or that and the Confederate flag, to the exclusion of, well, what was the first half of the thing he was talking about? One, he was talking about how racial conditions have changed a lot in the past 50 years, but still we have institutional racism. And later in that interview with Mark Maron, he was also talking about the main point he was trying to make, which was about gun violence and how we've got to do something about it and how disgusted he's been that Congress won't take any action. So we focus on these little social media friendly nuggets and we don't focus on the big picture.
Which is lazy. It's a matter of not looking to see or understand what the big picture is. It's easier to focus on the social media nugget. It's easier to focus on, again, our favorite, Don Lemon, standing, and I will say it, like a fool, holding a sign on a set at CNN, specifically to incite emotion and to upset people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what his motivation was for doing that.
I don't know that anybody knows what his motivation was.
I just don't
was.
Understand yeah. that. I mean, what context was he using it in? But that in and of itself, I think part of the problem here is that there are two issues, and the Washington Post has a good piece on that in their online issue today about the two issues that have vexed the president since his 2008 election, race and guns. But I would go even further. That issue has vexed the news media for a long time. Being able to tell a comprehensive story about what is the relationship between this country and guns, mm-hmm. and what's happening in this country in terms of race. We have not done a very good job of telling that comprehensively. And I think part of it is because many journalists don't really understand it, both internally, them themselves, and understanding it to be able to tell that story to a broader public.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to say that we shouldn't talk about what the president said, or for that matter, we shouldn't talk about the Confederate flag. The Confederate flag is hurtful to a lot of people. This issue comes up in the news all the time. It's appropriate for it to come up in this context. But again, can't we walk and chew gum at the same time as the media? We should be able to. But we deliberately don't, especially cable TV news. They deliberately decide to focus on what's easy to talk about, what's easy to stir emotions and maintain ratings and people coming onto their websites, and not talking about these other issues at the same time.
But then we turn around and we defend our actions. That's what bothers me more than anything else. We defend why we do that. And we say, because we feel like we're bringing news and information to the public that they need. In what way are we bringing news and information over and over again by talking about
on the half hour, same screaming talking heads,
exactly, about the word and the flag, and not talking about the underlying narrative there? We're creating this other narrative.
So one effort perhaps that is underway that we can start keeping an eye on that may be working to try and change that narrative, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and the head of the Bloomberg media empire has put $50 million to back a new outlet called The Trace, a news website that is intended to try to go up against the NRA and report solely and entirely on issues of gun violence, the influence of the gun lobby, and so on.
It's perfectly fine for anybody to want to put any kind of specialty media operation out there now, and I don't care who pays for it. I mean, it's basically the anti-NRA, and mm-hmm. if we have more of that content out there in the public discourse, that's great. I don't know if I would call it journalism, per se, any more than I would say what, you know, the NRA's public media operations put out is journalism, but at least it's a different context for us, if we want to read it, to think about.
Yeah, but I also think that the mainstream media, if you want to use that term, the mainstream media needs to really look at the gun issue in its totality. I mean, why is it that we cling to certain parts of the Constitution, the Second Amendment, as if we're still living in the 1780s when it was crafted, but in other parts of the Constitution, that's part of the living document, which is supposed to be that document. So, I mean, we need to really look at that and explore it across the country and within the individuals who are really supporting that. And I don't think we do a very good job of that.
I mean, it's interesting, Amy, because you have an example on mm-hmm. our links blog of an attempt, I think a kind of ham-handed attempt by Meet the Press to do just that, right? To talk about gun violence in the context of what happened in Charleston. But the way they did it, I mean, it really just didn't work.
It fell flat as could be. And our listeners and viewers can go to the links blog and watch a copy of that report. It was interviewing entirely black men in prison who had been convicted of gun crimes. And at the outset, Chuck Todd asked the audience to look at this as a colorblind example of the problems of gun violence, and took a whole lot of heat in the aftermath of what had gone on in Charleston for running this piece at this time, and the idea that it was really ill-timed to use that example in exactly that moment, that this isn't a colorblind time to do that.
I mean, I guess the intent was honorable, and they'd had this piece produced well before the shooting, but it just looked ham-handed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you cannot do that on a day when a white man goes in and kills 9 black people in a church.
And they're about to have church services for the first time within the hour.
To show this, that you've produced well ahead of time, of nothing but African-American men in jail for murder, and it just doesn't look good. It doesn't pass the smell test. Do that next week. Do that the week after. Are we going to stop talking about gun violence a week or two after Charleston? I hope not. There's plenty of time to bring this up.
Well, and here's the other problem I have with that. If you're talking about gun violence and you present that story with just African-American men who are in prison who committed gun violence.
In another state.
The problem I have, are you saying that whites and Hispanics and Asians, they haven't committed gun violence? Where were they in that piece? You know, that's the problem I have. I mean, we just had a huge story in Texas where you had the bikers. Mm-hmm. That was gun violence, and they were all white. Okay. And many of them had been in prison. Some of them had been in prison before for gun violence. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's the part that I don't understand about the story in and of itself, whether he presented it that day or he presented it
a month or two months from now or whatever. No,
and I hear, you know, Chuck Todd trying to justify why they did it. And again, I'm not saying that the intent was bad, but they realized fairly quickly what a mistake they'd made. I mean, even before the show aired in the Rocky Mountain and West Coast time zones, they changed the intro to that video to try to cover for what they had done.
You know, I think you're right. I think the intent was good. I just think that they could have done a better story. It could have been much more holistic in its approach than the way they presented it. And the timing was just off. I mean, there's just no way to get around that.
So while we're talking about NBC, Monday evening after work, I had a bit of a treat watching NBC. I got to watch an anchor I interned for back in the day officially take over as the main anchor of the NBC Nightly News. And Brian Williams, he's going back from whence he came, back to MSNBC, where he'll be anchoring breaking news. As part of this announcement, Williams sat down last week for a series of interviews with Matt Lauer, part of what many had dubbed the Brian Williams apology tour. Matt Lauer, though, didn't seem too quick to buy what Brian Williams was selling.
I told stories that were not true over the years. Looking back, it is very clear I never intended to. It got mixed up. It got turned around in my mind.
I worry as you say this, Brian, that people who are going to have listened to your apology on air and in other areas, Facebook and Stars and Stripes, who heard you use words like conflated aircraft or made mistakes with my memory of certain things, are now going to hear what you're saying now, and they're going to say, he's still saying he didn't intend to mislead people, and yet he didn't tell the truth, and he had to know, as the guy who lived through those experiences, that it wasn't the truth.
I see why people would say that. I understand it. This came from clearly a bad place, a bad urge inside me. This was clearly ego-driven, the desire to better my role in a story I was already in.
Maybe even more painful than watching the interview itself, watching the Today Show anchor's body language when they came back on camera at the end.
Brian will be returning to a new role at MSNBC and NBC in August. As part of the announcement yesterday, it was also announced that Lester Holt will become the permanent anchor of NBC Nightly News. Lester is, in my opinion, one of the best journalists, broadcasters, and people that I have ever met, and so I am very happy for him.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that awkward crosstalk there was only further punctuated by Carson Daly's silent, stilted movement on the couch, at one point sitting up and grimacing. It's a semi-silent reaction, perhaps, but maybe that's telling you what the other NBC staffers in the NBC News division think about this.
It's really awkward there, and it's really a shame that Lester Holt's ascension to this position has to be clouded by all of this crap with Brian Williams. Mm-hmm. But before we kind of get to NBC, just talk about Williams himself. Here's what I found really distressing. He was willing to say some things like, I said things that were wrong. I own this and I own up to it. But I wasn't trying to mislead people. But when he was asked by Matt Lauer, did you lie? Did you do it more than once? Then he all of a sudden goes into the passive voice. He says, well, what has happened has been fixed and has been dealt with, or it came from a bad place, not I did a bad thing. Mm-hmm. That's not an apology.
And the other thing was when Matt Lauer asked him, is there any other stories that you may have embellished or that you may have lied about that we need to talk about? He never answered that question. He basically said, well, there are other things, but I'm going to move forward. The old move forward tactic.
And of course, if NBC had released its own internal investigation into this, it would have been harder for him to. Yeah, and it's not happening. And that's in direct contradiction to what other major news organizations have done in the past, whether it was CBS with Dan Rather or the New York Times with Jason Blair. They put those reports out there for the public to read.
And I think, and this is just my own personal opinion, that there's some legal reasons for that. Either it's something contractual with Brian Williams, yeah, or it's something that NBC is worried about in terms of opening themselves up to some sort of litigation. I mean, I think that's the reason why that hasn't come out.
Here's another good example of that. How much money is Brian Williams losing? Oh, well, he was making $15 million a year, and now there's reports, well, he's only going to get $10 million a year. What a punishment.
I'm playing my mini violin over here.
And then he's going over to MSNBC, right, where, you know, you talked about what NBC staff think about this. One of them, I think it was quoted anonymously in a piece you got on the Lynx blog, is basically saying, well, what kind of message did that send? It's okay to lie on MSNBC if not on NBC. I think the staff is really worried
about
it. Well,
but I think the word they would use would be embellish.
Well, what the management would say as opposed to what the journalists working in the trenches there might say.
But I think overall, well, I mean, basically what this means is that NBC is basically trying to gain some of its credibility back, and putting Lester Holt in that position, I think, is going to give them that, because all the news media, when I say all the news media, I'm talking about, if you look at across the board, ABC, NBC, all when it was announced that he had gotten that position, they all basically came out and congratulated him. And
everybody
said it was
has
a good
rallied.
Move.
Everybody so, has rallied.
So I really think that that's what NBC is trying to do here.
Well, I'm going to be honest. I'm not even sure how to set up this last topic we're going to talk about today without potentially victimizing a possible sexual assault victim. Maybe the best way to go about it is to quote the Riverfront Times headline, how the Post-Dispatch shamed a possible rape victim and embarrassed itself. Here's what happened. Friday, the Post-Dispatch published a story about a Nixon aide who approached former House Speaker John Deal back in April when he was still in that position. She thought she might have been sexually assaulted. She'd been out the night before, had a few drinks, couldn't remember what happened. Well, Friday, the Post-Dispatch ran a story with vivid details of the police report she filed. They named her and ran a photo of her on the front page of the newspaper. Post-Dispatch political editor Christopher Ave went on KMOX earlier this week and said, the woman said she didn't know that she was assaulted, and that's why they felt they were okay. She didn't know for sure, so that's why they felt they were okay to use her name and photo on the front page of the newspaper.
One of the things that I would say is that those of you who are interested in this story really need to go to our Lynx blog and listen to that interview in its entirety, because I think that basically what bothered me about it was that she didn't know when she first reported it whether she had been assaulted, and then after the investigation, she was still claiming that she didn't know whether or not she had been assaulted. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact that she was in a relationship with Dial earlier, but had been out drinking with him and others on that night. I mean, all of that came out in the report. It came out in the interview on KMOX, and it really sort of opens it up. But I still find myself wondering, did you really need to give her name in that?
They could have possibly told the story. They could have gone about doing it in a way where they could still talk about, basically, they wanted to talk about the debauchery that they thought was going on in Jefferson City among our political leaders. But I think they could have done it without using her name in photo.
And I think they liked the angle that here was a former aide to the Democratic governor who was having an affair, mm-hmm, and right, maybe making an accusation of sexual assault when she was in an affair with a Republican leader. But first of all, Deal was never accused of being the person to perhaps have assaulted the woman.
She went to him for help.
And the fact that she still doesn't know whether it happened after a night of binge drinking says, well, maybe it did happen. So I think unless that story is really so important and the public really needs to know it, that we're going to violate her privacy in that way, we probably shouldn't have. It's not a slam dunk, but I don't think I would have done it.
Yeah, trying to make this connection between her, Nixon, Deal, Republicans, Democrats, I think it just all just gets kind of muddy, and you don't really, the connection is just not solid enough, I don't think it is.
And one of the defenses, frankly, that the editor was giving was, well, that she was blacked out, yet she was texting. How could those things have happened at the same time? Blacked out doesn't mean passed out. I mean, people can do all kinds of stuff and not remember it afterwards when they've been drinking a lot.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.